Divorce can get messy, but when a $600,000 wine cellar is involved, things get bubbly. Kelly Lise Murray joins Women Winning Divorce to spill the corks on dividing wine, wealth, and other luxury assets, with plenty of lessons for women along the way. Welcome to Women Winning Divorce, the podcast helping successful women navigate divorce with dignity so you can protect yourself, your children, and your assets. I'm Heather Quick, founding attorney at Florida Women's Law Group, where women win at life. This week, I sat down with lawyer, legal scholar, and serial entrepreneur Kelly Lise Murray to talk about the high-stakes world of luxury assets in divorce. We explored how courts handle expensive wine collections, what happens when one spouse drinks the good stuff, and the creative ways judges divide wealth when marriages and bottles go sour. If you've ever wondered how a $600,000 wine cellar could become a courtroom battlefield, this conversation is for you. Welcome to this week's episode of Women Winning Divorce. I'm Heather Quick, owner and attorney at Florida Women's Law Group. Today, Kelly Lise Murray, a lawyer, legal scholar, and serial entrepreneur, joins us. Kelly brings deep expertise in high-value assets in divorce, including luxury wine collections, real estate, art, and other unique property. Today, Kelly and I will be discussing how wine collections are treated in divorce litigation, since courts use to divide expensive collections from cash equalization to coin flips, and lessons from high-profile cases, including collections valued at over $600,000. Welcome, Kelly.
Thank you so much, Heather.
Well, I am so happy to have you. And for our listeners, I would like them to hear a little bit about you, because you have quite the breadth of experience that you bring to the table. So if you wouldn't mind, will you just share a little bit about yourself?
Yes. I've had a unique career path. I have degrees from Stanford University and Harvard Law School. I was a commercial litigator in Chicago, and I still have my Illinois law license, over 30 years at this point. I was law faculty at Vanderbilt for 18 years, retired a few years ago. And my side project while I was on the law faculty is now becoming my main focus. And I'm adding to that legal scholarship a podcast to support it. And I focused on wealth dispute resolution for over 15 years in legal scholarship, teaching judges and lawyers, financial professionals, and also teaching divorcing litigants what they need to know. And now I'm broadening that topic. So a lot of the cases I've curated in the divorce real estate and divorce mortgage space also have other assets, like luxury assets and retirement assets. And so I'm expanding those cases that I always curated and only taught part of them to teaching those other important assets.
Well, that is so fascinating to me, exciting, and gives us something, you know, a different point of view to look at some of these divorces. So could you give us a sense of why wine collections are such a common point of dispute in a high net worth divorce?
Well, one thing about wine is that it's such a unique type of asset. And I, as I always do, I wonder what the case law is on this. And so when I started researching it, there is not a lot of case law. And one of the leading legal treatises about asset valuation for marital dissolution has one case on wine. Well, I found more than that, so I feel a little accomplished. I supplemented his treatise there. But it's interesting because maybe people don't appeal. Maybe they're pretty good about it. You just don't know the reason why it's not litigated a lot. You have to be really upset with the result to spend 2 years or more appealing. Right. And in a high net worth divorce, there's a lot to consider. But what I found about wine is just the uniqueness of it. Is it simply personal property, meaning, you know, you went to Trader Joe's and you got some great wine, or is it a valuable collection? And then how you store it, how you insure it, how you value it, how you inventory it. Those are some of the key issues that are recurring in the cases that are available.
And it seems to me, and this, I would like your opinion, that in a lot of ways, it can be very subjective. Would you agree or not?
It's interesting. What the courts are looking at is, were you just going down to the wine cellar or the wine cooler and just grabbing one? That's more grocery item versus a climate controlled, professionally installed wine cellar with property and casualty insurance, you know, regular property and casualty insurance may have an exception for any single item worth more than $2,500. So in just a standard policy, if you have an item in your house worth more than that, you have to declare it to them and you have to prove its value for it to be insured for its value. So if you don't do that, that would be evidence that this is more of just a personal wine source and not a valuable collection.
That makes sense. Now, do you find that the emotional attachment to these collections make negotiations harder, or is it mostly about the monetary value?
What was the biggest wine collection I've seen in a litigated case is from an ultra net worth divorce in Ohio, mega assets. And they had wine collections in Ohio and France. Mm. And the way the court resolved it, they couldn't decide who got what. And that was really interesting to me because these were valuable assets. These were not merely the grocery store wine purchase. And even with that level of wealth and sophistication and probably huge teams on both sides, it still came down to something really simple that the parties themselves were directed to do to divide that collection. But what was also interesting about the cases that are available, the emotional attachment and casual use suggests it's not a valuable collection. And that's true of jewelry and some other assets, that if it's not fully, highly insured, if it does not have a professional appraisal, if there is not an ongoing inventory, because with wine, obviously, unlike jewelry, for example, you can simply drink it and dissipate it in that sense.
Right.
And so inventory is even more important for the wine. And then some people's collection is so substantial, it's stored off site. Some of the non-divorce wine collection cases I looked at, including insurance claims, was simply a third party, a professional third party, climate controlled, storing this very valuable wine collection, and they did a bad job. And so the claim was destruction of, not all the wine that went in, not all of it came back out. So you can imagine.
That is fascinating. And that would make sense to me as far as like more case law that you would see, because obviously it is a valuable collection. It is insured. There was a claim. So something went wrong, and both the individual trying to secure that and then the business, so it would be more likely to be appealed for our listeners. But it's fascinating because that's the beauty of the law. You can look at that to gain some insight and direct the court.
Absolutely.
To how to handle it.
Especially in your state. Just so you know, I looked up some very specific searches for Florida, and you do not have wine cases. Isn't that a little bit shocking? Some states like Louisiana and Ohio and Connecticut, they have some significant wine cases, but not Florida. So apparently you're all really agreeable about your wine collections to this point.
I would find that hard to believe. However, we'll keep our eyes open. Now, tell us about the $600,000 wine mystery.
This one is a high asset divorce in Connecticut, and the husband was a successful hedge fund manager. The marriage broke down over infidelity and criminal conduct investigation of the hedge fund. The husband ended up with a $1.3 million lien by the SEC on his business. This marriage broke down. Before the breakdown of the marriage, it was documented that they had purchased $600,000 worth of wine in the wine cellar of the marital home. This was a major collection, $600,000. Right. 1 month after the wife filed for divorce, the wine's gone. Mm. So that's how it started. Now, one of the best things the wife did to protect herself, because the shenanigans in divorce litigation are equal opportunity. Sometimes she could be the shenaniganer, sometimes he could be. In this example, the husband's the shenaniganer about the wine.
Okay.
The wine, the wife protected herself. It was brilliant what she did. Either early on in the divorce or before she even filed for divorce, she did an inventory. So she did a professional inventory of the wine in the marital house. And then a month later, when the wine disappeared, she did another inventory. And that turned out to be material evidence that really helped her succeed in her divorce regarding that asset. That was tremendous. But here's the other thing. Not all bad deeds go unpunished. The husband hired movers to remove wine. Well, guess what that created? A paper trail. Hiring movers created a paper trail. And I'll just refer to some of the specifics of the case. The husband testified that he removed only $30,000 to $40,000 worth of wine. Remember, the original value was $600,000. Who knows? They may have agreed what they drank before the divorce. But he claimed that he only took $30,000 to $40,000. That's not what the movers' records show. So what does that do? When the movers contradict the husband loses major credibility. And this court actually said about the husband, I want to quote this, because you never want this said about you or your client. The defendant's problem with telling the truth continued throughout this proceeding. That's really bad. He had no credit. Any time it was he said, she said, he lost. But here's what the moving record showed, that they moved 16 cartons and 13 crates, plus another 7 crates, and that the husband insured 2 cases for $250,000 alone of what was removed. So he testified, oh, I only took $30,000 to $40,000. Well, that's not what the moving record showed. And the insurance records insuring what was moved, because obviously insuring valuable wine when it's climate controlled in your house is different than it being moved. That's a much higher risk, easier to damage wine. And so he smartly took out additional insurance, but that was a paper trail that he really should have been advised to follow himself. That would have been much better for his credibility. And then the mover's notes, the defendant returned to the house several times to pick up more wine. And that's how we went from 13 cases to 20 cases, 8 more cases of wine for 20 cases total. He removed approximately 1,200 bottles of wine, valuable wine.
Well, and Kelly, I think that is great. An example of like, what does this teach us about like documentation? And, you know, a paper trail and what to do if you are in this type of case.
Absolutely. But also to recognize if there's a paper trail, you're stuck with it.
Yeah.
And every lawyer advises every client, tell the truth. But the documents would also help people see the importance of telling the truth. When the document says this, you're trying to deviate. Mm-hmm. Well, unless you have countervailing evidence, you're stuck with what the document showed. And here, the husband did not testify that he insured 2 cases for $250,000. The wife's evidence proved that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know you have certainly seen these types of cases where there are assets. You know, the client tells us that, okay, there are these certain assets. I can remember back so many years ago, a couple of different kinds. One with coins,
yes.
Right? And she's like, we have this saved all these coins. And so the advice before filing is exactly that. Inventory, like pictures, but the value because, right, you don't, your pictures show they exist and those are much easier to then move, you know, easier than the wine. Same with like bonds. We had one case so many years ago and they had a safe filled with bonds. And, you know, we advise her to, you know, inventory them, picture them, like, or put them in a safe deposit box because if he walks out of that with them and we don't know the value, then it's walked out and it can really hurt you and impact you financially.
What's really interesting about different types of valuable items like coins, some coins are valuable merely for their silver content. So it's the year, quarters up to a certain year, all of that. And then other coins, it's whether the market's flooded with them or they're more rare. And so that's those types of a collection, it's worth it to invest in professional appraisal and inventory, professional inventory. It's enough, at least get your own inventory and video yourself, you know, video it, narrate it, so you're time stamping it, all of those things. But for the valuable items, that professional involvement will go a long way.
It really will. And, you know, that's what is so important because, you know, the client may think, oh, I don't want to go spend, you know, $1,000 or maybe a little bit more, but you could miss out on a very large asset that will generally trump that and or find out that it isn't worth as much as you think. Like either way, it's very valuable information and provides the documentation that you really need in a divorce.
Right. I was disappointed to find out stamps are no longer as valuable as they used to be because people don't collect stamps anymore. So another thing to think about is there a market for it? If it's the type of asset, there's not a market. Or liquidation value. So there are different types of value. And if the item is going to actually sell for less because it's more of a liquidation sale than a bidding war, then we may have to adjust our expectations on the marital balance sheet.
Yeah, that is a really good point because, you know, oftentimes we've seen the divorces where they have these inflated values or what they believe something to be worth, but then there's no market for it. So it does change the outcome and the perspective on it. It's like, okay, well now, one, we're not fighting over it because it's not really worth anything. But two, you know, that's going to change the landscape of the divorce and the division of assets.
Absolutely.
Now, you also had a case where the husband drank several bottles of wine despite a stay on community property. I would love to hear about that, please.
So this one's so interesting. And again, it's the uniqueness of the asset type. So wine, unlike coin collection, you can drink it.
Right.
And it's a unique form of dissipation because it's not a gambling debt. I'm a wine connoisseur. Maybe you're highly educated in wine and I'm a wine connoisseur and it was an important business dinner and I was impressing my boss. I mean, you can make some pretty decent arguments that it actually enhanced the marital estate to land that business deal with this really expensive bottle of wine. So it's not cut and dry there. But in this case, this was a Louisiana Intermediate Appellate Court case from 2009. In this case, the judge actually found an equitable way to divide this. Here's what happened. When the husband drank some of the bottles, the wife wanted more assets offset. So she wanted more of something else because, hey, he drank that and we no longer have those bottles and our wine collection is worth less. What the trial court did that the intermediate appellate court affirmed was to select the highest value. So her appraiser, the highest total value of the asset before it was dissipated. So before the husband drank the bottles and then awarded all of the wine to the husband. If he truly drank some of it, he actually received less than the number that was on the marital balance sheet. And so any dissipation was correctly attributed to the person everybody agreed drank some of it.
That was interesting. That's a very actually judicious result for, I mean, sometimes we get results in court and we're like, that really was not, didn't seem to be, you know, equitable, but that seems to be very equitable.
Exactly. So there aren't many cases, but they're really interesting.
Yeah. Well, they are in the courts. Have to, like with that one, the consumption, you know, deal with it creatively, which is cool. Now, what can women do if they suspect their spouse is hiding or depleting assets during the divorce process?
Here's what I would say preemptively. So while you are married and not contemplating divorce, valuable assets should be valued and insured. Yes. And when you take those steps, you're not preparing for divorce. You're being a smart owner of those valuable assets. And your insurance company, your property and casualty insurer, they only insure known risks. They're not insuring risks you haven't told them about. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense. And those inventories will be the floor. Okay, here's where it is. That is the first step. And then just like the wife in the Connecticut divorce with the $600,000 worth of wine, she actively inventoried it professionally. It was relevant and reliable inventory that the court weighed heavily in her favor. So doing that, if you're the one filing for divorce, you can take those steps beforehand or right after you get served. We need to get that excellent team together. So top legal representation, and they're the quarterback telling you, all right, these are other team members we may need based on what you're showing me as your assets and what your goals are in this marital asset division. So that's some of it. It's the documentation. But the other point I want to bring out that I've seen for over the past 15 years focusing on wealth dispute resolution is this. Do not rely on the other side's numbers. Do not. Yes. I've seen cases even recently where that was held against the person. So the allegation was, well, the other side omitted assets, misvalued them. And on appeal, the court held, hey, you chose to rely on those numbers. You're stuck with it. That I just want to get the divorce over with kind of reaction. Do not do that. You will be sorry later. That in my experience, reviewing multi-state cases for over a decade, make sure you and your team agree what's most important here. What are the most valuable assets? What should we spend our efforts on? And then get your own due diligence, because relying on the other side can be held against you. And even in mediation or collaborative practice where they agree, I'll just give you everything you need. How do we know that happens? So being a little more proactive can enforce a fairness that the other side may or may not be following.
Exactly. That is so important. And that's just part of advocating for yourself. And then you can make good decisions because you can trust the information that you have. And it's often can be that, you know, like, for example, what was it? Like, you know, let's talk about jewelry. Like, you may have like an older appraisal or something, or this is what they said it's worth. Well, but now gold has gone up. And so then, you know, the cost of that jewelry, like the appraised value may be more, or even though it's probably sentimental, and I am just throwing this out here, Kelly. So like, I don't have like, you know, verified like experts, but I'm just thinking for our listeners, like, because you see, it becomes very popular to resell a Rolex and get a Rolex. And, you know, depending on, like you were talking with the stamps, the demand, like if it could be really like, these are things that now are very popular, there's a higher demand, it could be worth more than you even realized. And that's why it's just so important. And also in divorce, I have said this more than once, that, you know, is your husband, you believe what you want, but is that really, is he really looking out for your best interest or maybe his? So when there's the valuing and who he's hiring to value, you know, do you really think that he is putting your interest above his? Because generally that is not what we see.
In divorce and other wealth dispute resolution, so just think of trust battles and probate challenges and all that. When money is at issue, perfectly reasonable people change temporarily, so to speak. So, yes, you
need. They do. And, you know, we were talking before about the emotional attachment. And a lot of times that can change, like, because I love the way you brought up the probate. You have a belief, an emotional connection to something. And in your mind, you're like, oh, maybe my parent or whatever always said this was so valuable. This was a really, and so you get, things can be skewed without the professionals really giving you the true value.
Absolutely. And it is there a market for it? I have a really interesting example of a New York divorce. Uh-huh. And this is more on the pro-mediation, pro-collaborative process.
Okay.
It was a unique artwork collection. The market was limited. And it was valuable. It was, some of it was separate property. Some of it became marital property. It was the wife's collection. So she's keeping the bulk of it. And in dividing this marital estate, the husband's share would be 10% of her art collection.
Okay.
And in order to achieve that cash 10%, she was going to have to liquidate 29% of her art. Ooh. So that's where the math presents an opportunity at negotiation, because there's a number somewhere between liquidating 29% and his 10% that if he agrees to receive in kind instead of in cash, he can receive more of the art and she can lose less of the art. Right. They can get closer to the middle.
Maybe then it will appreciate. Maybe it will be worth more later on if the market increases or whatever.
Exactly. So that depends on the liquid asset, the other liquid assets. You know, that may not be an option if they have a lot of debt and he needs the cash now. But if they have other assets, that's a really creative solution that collaborative practice teaches. And you can even do that in mediation. You don't have to do collaborative practice to raise that issue. But that's where that's a trust-building example that could really go a long way to negotiating other assets, to show, especially on the wife's side, to say, all right, I'll give you more and I'll lose less. So if she gives him 20% of her art collection, she's netting 9% ahead. Otherwise, she has to liquidate 29%. So there's room for her to give up more, for him to get more, and she loses less. That's a win-win.
Well, and you know, that is perfectly leading into my next question, because it's talking about creative division methods, right? Because that is sometimes that you can do that when you're in mediation, right? Or a collaborative process. And here in Florida, mediation is required. So the opportunity is always there, right? And because you just have to go. But, you know, what are some other things that can help resolve things that are a little bit more creative outside the box?
Well, apparently Ohio has a local rule of creativity.
Ooh. Ooh.
This is the ultra net worth divorce in Ohio, wine collections in Ohio and France. And in order to divide the wine, the watches, the jewelry, and the art, it was like a sports fantasy team draft. The husband and wife were directed to decide who goes first and then pick one item at a time until everything was divided.
Okay.
And that helps you prioritize. Hopefully they did it by collection, because that would be a lot of prep work.
That would be a lot. Yes.
What's my first item? Oh, shoot, he picked it. Now what's my second item? What's left? But in terms of fairness, they were keeping everything and they couldn't decide who got what. Now, there's a famous photo that has circulated on the internet. It's from the 1980s, and the hair and the clothing in the state divorce courtroom look like the 80s. And husband and wife are kneeling on the floor of the courtroom with a huge pile of Beanie Babies between them. And apparently that was that judge's solution, because back then Beanie Baby collections were also very valuable. Just pick one at a time till you're done.
And, you know, yeah, for our listeners, sometimes when you get in front of a judge, that's all they can do to decide. And so it is, you know, it can be in your best interest. One, obviously know the real values, but to work for creative resolutions that may keep you both from picking one Beanie Baby at a time.
The time right? that would, I'm hoping AI could actually help with that. And you know, if you both submitted to a neutral your lists and then the AI just says, well, based on these lists, if you just go down the list, here you go. Because the time that would take to pick one at a time, who are you paying? That's a lot of hourly fees to get that done, especially with
it
that
really
ultra
is
asset.
And you know, I don't know about your experience, which is vast, but you know, a lot of the judges really just don't have time or patience for that. Well, they don't have the patience, guaranteed.
Right. They want that done. Absolutely.
For the lists and lists. And, you know, if there cannot be like some way to resolve it and divide it, they're usually going to punish both the parties by coming up with a way that it really doesn't satisfy either one of you because they feel like you should have been able to come to a resolution.
And sometimes that feels like justice, that whole, if you're both a little bit unhappy, that feels fair. Mm-hmm. That's another reason to really do your work before mediation, because mediation, you obviously get more say in the division.
Yes, yes. Now, so when the courts are assigning value to like rare or collectible wine, how do they do that?
The evidence I've seen is expert appraisal, but then not just market value, if it's a liquidated value. So we need to be prepared that if the item has to be liquidated, and that's true of sports memorabilia. Okay. Maybe you've inherited your grandfather's sports memorabilia collection. That would give you a reason to learn about this. I've had a reason to learn about this. It's fascinating, but it is time consuming. And something may have a value, but unless the auction houses are willing to put it into their auction, you're looking more at a liquidated value, especially from a brick and mortar store, for example, a brick and mortar sports store. They have overhead, so they're not going to give you retail. They need less than half value to you so they can sell it and also support their own efforts. So money now, less, you know, the present value of money, less cash now versus waiting till later. A lot of those considerations. But sometimes if the asset would be sold in a liquidated value sense, it's going to change the marital balance sheet, and that should be decided up front. That and then assets that have tax consequences. One of the things, and this isn't necessarily valuable assets, but one of the other things is this apples to oranges that I keep seeing. Just because both numbers are $100,000 doesn't mean you net $100,000 depending on the tax treatment. Right. And not every state requires it. But one thing I love about Florida, off topic, but this is great law in Florida, the court has to consider the tax consequences. That is not true in other states. So if you present the evidence of tax consequences and the trial court doesn't, that gets reversed on appeal. So definitely be looking at equalizing. This is our appraised value, or this is what we've insured it for. But, you know, you insure things for an amount that might not be what it would sell for or liquidate. So just be a little more mindful of the math.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, a lot of times, obviously, when we're in a divorce that, you know, our clients will be like, well, we paid this or we paid that. And it's, you know, when we're valuing it, and that was such a good point that you made, it's like, all right, well, maybe all their furniture, which isn't antiques. You know, it's like, okay, it's really estate sale. I won't, you know, demean you by saying garage sale, but it's more of an estate sale, like liquidation cost. And it's not the replacement value of that, nor is it if you, you know, and I think that's really hard unless I think we're talking about those, you know, rare collectible things where there's a market.
With
because
provenance.
What if you collect this kind of wine that nobody wants?
Right. Or counterfeit. So the other wrinkle with wine is there's a case in California where a man purchased $18 million in wine that turned out to be counterfeit. Can you imagine?
If you're spending that much. How is wine counterfeit, though? You got to tell me that.
There's a different case where someone purchased wine allegedly owned by Thomas Jefferson. All right, so this wine was supposed to be from the 1780s.
Oh my
it was
gosh.
Actually from the 1940s when it was tested. So I think the lesson there is if you're going to insure the wine, make sure you test it first, because in the California case, he filed an insurance claim on this $18 million counterfeit wine, and the property and casualty insurer was vindicated in court. Hey, we just insured what you received. We didn't know whether it was counterfeit. That's your job. And why would you spend $18 million and not have it tested? That seems like a
because,
huge investment.
I never would have thought of that, but I was thinking, okay, you're buying this, right? And in wine, that's why this is such a cool topic, because okay, you're buying art or whatever. Clearly, to look at it, but wine, okay, you're buying it to collect it, but not to drink it. So if it's not good, you don't know. But I think proper, like if you're insuring it for that much, seems like the insurance company would want to test it as well.
Well, now they have, but this is where the insurance company now doesn't need to test it based on this precedent. They didn't insure its authenticity. They insured its physical safety. This is property and casualty insurance.
Yeah.
So you probably, you know, baseball player pitchers can insure their arms and things. You probably can buy insurance. But then if the insurance is for the authenticity of the Thomas Jefferson wine, then the insurance company would test it. But for just property and casualty insurance, it was the physical safety of the wine. And of course, then you would have to show you're storing it properly. You know, that's like not repairing
right.
a
roof. That's
a
like
leak
if there's
roof.
An earthquake, probably California, right? Like that was the main thing. Like, okay, hey, we're going to insure the safety, not necessarily that it is really as rare and collectible as what you paid for it. We're not that.
Right.
That's fascinating. Well, insurance is never really fascinating.
That's what I love about this legal scholarship that I do. I find these cases just. Whoa, I had no idea. So some of the facts are really shocking and interesting. The facts are shocking. The law is interesting. And yeah. If it can help people, I'm happy to do that. So really appreciate the opportunity to be on your podcast.
So I'm so thankful that you are. I do. I think this is so interesting. And let me ask you this. Do you see any common mistakes women make when it comes to documenting or valuing these types of assets before filing for divorce?
The main thing is no docs, no documents, low documents, and then relying on the other side. So I brought this up earlier.
Yeah,
but that's the main thing I see. And I see it a lot. Mm. And I'm seeing it in appellate cases. So what that means is this litigant didn't get serious until appeal. That is way too late. If you've made mistakes at the before mediation and before trial, the appeal just means you were really angry about your result. But I'm sure you would advise you were unlikely to succeed. And most of them do not succeed because property division is permanent. That key fact is why I've spent over 15 years researching wealth dispute resolution in marriage. Dissolution cases, property division is permanent. You have to get your information, make that informed decision even before your mediation, because if you sign something at mediation, that can be a binding contract that you can't undo. So it's really critical getting the team, getting your legal representation, making sure that that is a great choice, because then they're going to help you direct the rest of the team as needed. Give you choices. You can choose what to invest in. But depending on what's important and what's needed, you know, needs and wants, all of those, depending on that, we need to consider investing in professional appraisals of these higher valued assets.
Yes, I'm glad that you reiterated that, because it is important. And I think sometimes, you know, and I'll say women because we represent women only, you know, feel like it's not worth the investment, right? I've just hired a lawyer. We're going through all this. But as you mentioned, you know, throughout, it could be thousands of dollars. And that could mean the difference between your settlement really being equal and equitable or not, or the final result, because the judge is going to rely on the expert testimony or documentation. And if, you know, your husband presents it and it's unchecked, you're out of luck.
You are. You will. And people appeal that and they lose as expected, because if you don't do your own due diligence, every state, including Florida, requires each spouse to do their own due diligence. You have to identify and value assets, and you have to identify and quantify debts. And you can't just rely on the other side unless it's something like liens that are public, you know, or I should say, especially with something like liens, you can't say, oh, he didn't tell me about a lien, because that's public and you and your team could find it. So there is that due diligence obligation is enforced, but it's also in your best interest and your financial future. Given Florida's semi-recent change in alimony, asset division is even more critical.
Absolutely. Yes. You really, you know, how do you make decisions and how do you present a case if you don't have good information and good numbers that you can rely on?
Exactly.
And then regretting that later, that's all that is, because you can't do anything about it, which is, you know, a terrible thing. As lawyers, we don't want to tell you when you bring us something, there's nothing we can do.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, that's so true in those kinds of cases. Now, Kelly, before we go, I like to ask our guests what winning at life means to you, since we are the Women Winning Divorce Show.
For me, it's finding your purpose and pursuing it. And the phrase I like the best is, there's time. You know, it feels like I'm this age. There's time. There's time to pursue your purpose and this change. Heather, you've mentioned the transition phase, the process of divorce as a transition. There's time to add a new purpose. There's time to do all of that, and you really owe it to yourself.
It's awesome. I love it. Well, we've reached the end of our show today. Thank you so much, Kelly, for joining us to talk about wine wealth and all the drama that comes with high-stakes divorce. Your insight shows women how to protect themselves, their assets, and maybe even their favorite bottles. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Before we wrap up, I want to share something personal. On February 17th, my book, Unbreakable Divorce, will be released on Amazon. I wrote this book for the woman who feels scared, unsure, or quietly asking herself what comes next. After walking along so many women through divorce, I know this season can feel overwhelming, but it doesn't have to break you. Unbreakable Divorce is a reminder that even here, you are strong, capable, and not alone. Listeners, if you or someone you know in the Northeast Florida area is going through or even thinking about divorce, you're not alone. Taking that first step can feel overwhelming, but it doesn't have to be. Our newsletter is filled with actionable advice tailored to guide you through this process. By signing up, you'll gain the tools to face the unknown with courage and see if we're the right fit to support you during this life-changing time. Don't wait. Click the link in the show notes, fill out the form, and take the first step toward building a brighter future today.